Well, for the young people, if you're ever asked to give your testimony, there's three parts: what you were, what happened after that. So that's what we're doing. As I've often told people, my life is a tale of two women and about a half dozen men. I won't take time to run down the list of all the men. And my wife, you know, she entered the picture during my college age. My mother, you've not known. She did visit down here once, but that would have been a very long time ago. We lost her in 2015. But when it comes to my testimony, I really do have to start with her, because in terms of what was, it actually started before I was born. In fact, the night that I was born. I'm from Pennsylvania, and I was born on December the 1st, a long time ago. And it was a very bad snowstorm that night, and I don't understand all the medical parts of this, but there is a particular problem that comes with Rh negative reaction in birth. And it was thought that I was going to have that problem. And that was a bigger problem than normal, because our local hospital was small and unable to handle that problem. So they're going to have to ship me off to Pittsburgh, which would have been a 50-mile drive through, at that time, a blinding snowstorm. Typically, when we had bad snowstorms, the road between our town, Uniontown, Pennsylvania, and Pittsburgh would drift shut. The winds coming across there would just shut down the road. So this was back in the days before there were any helicopters that flew people to hospitals. As a matter of fact, the ambulance just had a driver. That was all there was. My aunt was a nurse. She volunteered to ride in the ambulance should the problem develop. But while they were anticipating and making all those problems, my mother prayed that if God would be pleased to spare my life, that he might also be pleased to take me into the ministry. That was her prayer. If you've read my commentary on Matthew, and if you haven't, you'll answer for it at the last day, so I'd get it now while you have time. But that commentary is dedicated to my mother, whose Hannah-like prayer was the beginning of my walk with the Lord, but I didn't actually come to know the Lord till much later. But it happened that night. Now, before I was actually born and the problem didn't develop, so we didn't have that ambulance ride, the minister from the church had heard about the problem, so he came. His name was Edwin Houck, and he came to my mother and said he had heard about the problem and he wanted to have prayer, and he said, "Why don't we pray that God would spare your son and use him in the ministry?" He said that. And she said, "I have already committed him to the Lord." I never knew about that prayer. Nothing was ever told to me about that. That was like Mary. She just pondered it in her heart. That was kept. Now, she continued to pray, but I knew nothing about that. Now, I grew up a church-going kid. I was born on a Monday. I was in church the next Sunday. My mother did not believe that having a baby was a good reason to be missing church. So she was going to be there, and if she was there, I was going to be there too. I was in the nursery being cared for by another one of my aunts, but I was at church on that Sunday. And after 1 year, I had a perfect attendance record for the nursery, and they put my picture in the newspaper. Now, that tells you something about the town I grew up in. There wasn't a lot of news, and so They were looking for anything they could throw in there. So there was a picture of me as a one-year-old getting a Sunday school award because I had perfect attendance during that year. But that did lay down the tracks. We went to church without fail. There was later on in another blinding snowstorm that came through in the winter, and we already had 3 to 4 feet out there. The roads were closed. We lived about 3 miles from the church. My mother was going to walk us to church. She was getting us, and my dad just stepped in, and he said, "No, we're not. We are not doing this." He said, "You'd get stuck out there and freeze to death. We're not doing this." But my mother would have done it had she not been submissive to her husband. So we went to church a lot. And the church that I went to required of us Bible memory work every week. So as you came, and my mother was diligent, make sure I was ready with my Bible verse. During the summers, we had 2 weeks of vacation Bible school. You had a verse for every day of vacation Bible school, and you had a big passage to recite at the end. That was kind of the grand prize, you know, to recite the whole chapter of something or other. And we always got awards. So I had lots of church, and I had lots of Bible so far as individual verses were concerned. Now, with all of that, I'd have to say I was never actually taught to read the Bible as if it were a book. You know, it was a collection of verses that you memorized and things like that. But I was never actually taught to kind of read the Bible from beginning to end. So all my Bible knowledge was piecemeal. But lots of church, lots of Bible, lots of conformity to rules. I was a rule keeper. I did what my mother and father told me to do. I mentioned my mother the most because she was the most active one. My dad didn't interact with us a whole lot. There were 5 kids. He worked a whole lot to try to put food on the table for 5 kids. But he didn't interact with us a whole lot. It was my mother who was into athletics. As soon as we could learn to throw a baseball and get a glove, I had a glove. I'm a Pittsburgh Pirates fan, being from Western Pennsylvania, and any of you who are old baseball fans, somebody important just recently died. Does anybody know who died? Who died? Bill Mazeroski, that's right. My first baseball glove was Bill Mazeroski. he's the guy that hit the home run, Game 7, World Series, against the New York Yankees, and Maz did it. It's the only time there has been a walk-off home run in Game 7. There was one in Game 6, but it's the only time. But Bill Mazeroski, and it was my mother that taught me baseball, basketball, football, you know, after a while. I was kind of in the middle of the 5 kids. My older brother was 7 years older. He taught me everything I knew about sports along the way. He was just a good older brother, and despite the fact that I was 7 years younger, he always included me in everything. So I was a rule keeper, I was a church goer, I was a Bible memorizer, but I did not know the Lord. I did not know the Lord. I feel sure that the gospel would have been preached in my church, especially in my very youngest days, but I do not recall ever clearly hearing the gospel in my church. Now, along with that, every time there was a Billy Graham crusade on the television, we were plopped down in front of it. My mother saw to it that we were there. I knew just as I am without one plea from beginning to end. Once there was actually a smaller Graham effort in our city. One of the associate evangelists came, and they had a movie to show and whatnot, and so my mother saw to it that we all had tickets to that. For some reason, we didn't all go as a family. We had to go in two different sittings. I don't know why that was, but five kids. I suppose you just can't make it all work that everybody be there at once. So anyway, we were there, and my older brother and I went to the Billy Graham movie. And after the movie was done, you know, the evangelist comes out, and, you know, they start to play the Just As I Am and whatnot. Well, I've heard this many, many times. I know what you're supposed to do. I'm a rule keeper, you know. I do what I'm supposed to do. So I said to my older brother, I said, are we going to go forward? He said, do you want to go forward? Go ahead. And I sat there for a minute, and I couldn't believe what was on happening. I said, are you not going forward? He said, if you want to go forward, go ahead. I said, Mother, Mother will be mad if we don't go forward. He said, go if you want to go. So I went, all right. He wanted to be a rebel. I went forward. So I went down. I did what they told me to do, and they gave me a little booklet, and I was supposed to go home and have a quiet time and so on. I took that book home. I put it down on the shelf. I never picked it up again. My life was just filled with athletics at the time. Played baseball spring and summer. Football season comes. You get into football. You deal with it till basketball season starts. Then I do basketball. I just did sports year-round. And when it came time to go to college, the idea that you had to pick a major with the idea that someday you'd get a job, none of that had ever occurred to me. None of that had ever occurred to me. I'd been real interested in the military, watching military shows, you know, combat, and the gallant men, things like that. So I thought a lot about the military. Of course, I've let the cat out of the bag here, but for all of you who are basketball fans out there, I was recruited by Bobby Knight. Anybody know Bobby Knight? I was recruited by Bobby Knight. I told that in a church in Indianapolis. And I said, now you'll be impressed with this. I was recruited by Bobby Knight. I couldn't believe it. I said, of course, he wasn't at Indiana then. He was at the West Point Military Academy. So anyway, I was thinking about I was just a high school kid graduating. I had no idea what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go. I got an appointment to the United States Coast Guard Academy, had a Naval ROTC scholarship, but I had no idea where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. I had the cousin of my mother's brother. My mother was the youngest of six children, and this brother had been much, much older, so her cousin was virtually her age on that, and he was the county superintendent of schools. And so he took a real interest in me, and he would call every couple of weeks, you know, wanting to know if I'd picked a college and what was I going to do, and I don't know, I'm doing this. Do I want to play football? Do I want to play basketball? And whatnot. All my football offers were small college. All my basketball offers were small college and whatnot. And I just didn't know what I did. The only thing that was in my mind was I ought to go someplace big so that I'll have many options. I don't know that anybody ever told me that, but I just thought I better go someplace where there's a lot of options out there because I don't know what I'm going to do. And it's a good thing I did, because I changed majors in college five times in five semesters. I got out on time, because fortunately I'd moved around enough that I had my distribution requirements filled out by the time I did zero in, but I'm getting ahead of myself on that. So anyway, a church-going kid, knew a fair amount of the Bible, kept an awful lot of rules. People thought I was good stuff. I did not know the Lord. I was as lost as I could be. I was just living for myself. and for the praise of my mother. That was what I was living for. In the end, my cousin, virtually my uncle by age, but my cousin, called the University of Pittsburgh and talked to the basketball coach. And being county superintendent of schools, I guess you can just call up and they'll actually talk to you. So anyway, he persevered and got through. And the coach said, well, we've given out all our scholarships, so we're kind of full. He said, well, he's a good student. He probably won't need a scholarship. He'll probably get an academic scholarship. He said, well, all the better. We don't have to pay for him. He said, yeah, send him down. We'll have a visit. So I went down. Now, I grew up southwestern Pennsylvania out in the coal fields. I grew up playing basketball by myself, playing football. I'd go out in the backyard. There weren't a lot of kids around. Every now and again, you'd get a playmate. But I grew up on my own outside a city in a depleted coal mining region. And I had to drive myself down to Pittsburgh to find my way to the university. It's 30,000 students in those days. And I just loved it from the moment I drove into the big city. I look back with just utter amazement that I took to it. But I drove into the city, and I just loved it from the moment I got there. And I loved the coaches that I had lunch with, and I decided to go there. I had to walk on. But I made the team my freshman year. And then that was the last year before freshmen became eligible for varsity, so I made the varsity too. But I knew I was now in a different world. I knew that the first day that I showed up at the gym, and this is before the season starts, so the coaches aren't out there. There's nothing organized. Just everybody's playing. You pick up on a team, and you go out, and so on. And there was a pro team in Pittsburgh, and the pro players came to our field house. So there's pros out there playing. There's the college varsity team and whatnot we're picking up. And so I'm a guard. I bring the ball up, and I pass off, and I do what I did in high school. I'd go down, try to screen off a guy, and I got into the lane, and somebody goes, boom! And I'm down on the floor like I've been in a prize fight. And I thought, this is a different game. This is a real different game. It was more, that was a foul where I came from. No, not a foul. I was here first. And so on. But there was a guy who played for the Pittsburgh Pipers back in those days. His name was Connie Hawkins. Old folks may know him. He was kind of Dr. J before there was a Dr. J. Okay, he's 6'7", 6'8", hands that can hold almost two basketballs. And I'm playing against him. There is a long rebound, You know, the ball hits the basket and bounces way out. And it comes to this guy. And I'm back, and he's alone. Here comes a guy, 6'7" or up, dribbling down there, and I thought, if he gets near the basket, this thing is over. So if I'm going to stop him, it's got to be out front. So when do you steal a basketball? Anybody know when you go for a basketball? What do you time it? When it's going down. Good job, Rob. When the ball goes down, you go for the ball, okay? Because once he releases it, that's the longest span of time that he will not be able to control the ball. So he's coming down, bearing down on me, and I'm standing between him and the basket, and I'm sure I was going. And when he got close enough for me to make my move, I made my move, and he just palmed the ball. So he didn't go down. He took one step to the left, and he launched himself from about 18 feet out, and he just glided through the air with the greatest of ease and dunked that ball. All right. That's one example of how out of my league I was. All right? I was good enough to make the team, but I would sit on the bench. In fact, after I made the varsity team, I got in one game. The reason I got in one game is that we were so far ahead, there was nothing else of interest to do,
But to empty the bench.
It was the first time of the year that our team had scored over 100 points. We were the University of Pittsburgh, Division I. We had a high school first team All-American on the team, a guy by the name of Billy Knight. We had a good team. Those guys lost, I say those guys because I only played 2 years, so I wasn't playing my junior, senior year. But my classmates lost to the eventual champion, NC State, in the quarterfinals, the Sweet 16 of it. It was a good team. So we were beating the daylights out of Ohio Westland. I suppose it's fitting that it was against the Arminians that I got in. anyway, I got in. There was just nothing of interest in that game beyond the fact that we had scored 100 points. So the next morning, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Pitt whips OW, you can't fit Ohio Wesleyan in a single column, Pitt whips OW 104-67. And the article begins. At 4:15 remaining in the game last night, Mark Ross finally got his chance. And when he did, it was the absolute end of the Pitt bench. Thereafter, I was A.E. Ross, the absolute end. That would turn out to be the absolute end of my basketball life. Those 4 minutes. I scored 4 points. I never missed a shot. Who can claim that? Look it up in the NCAA. A point per minute, never having missed a shot. 1 for 1 from the field, 2 for 2 from the line. my shot from the field hit the 100 mark. So later in the article, you know, with, I don't know, minute 27 left in the game, fate decreed another moment of distinction for Ross when his 18-foot jumper took the score right off the scoreboard. We didn't even have a scoreboard that could hold 100 points. All right, so double zeros flash up there in it. But that was the end of my career. That's why I had gone to the University of Pittsburgh. My whole life had been geared to playing ball of some sort or other. I love baseball, I love football, I love basketball. That's just how it worked out with a confused kid. But it took me there because that's where I would meet the Lord. My college roommate, those of you who are NFL fans, my freshman year college roommate is a guy by the name of Dave Wanstead. He's a commentator with Fox Sports, I think, last. So Wanstead made a big career, coach of the Chicago Bears, and later at the University of Pittsburgh. His head coaching days didn't work out as well as his coordinator days. But Wanstead, first week of class, went to the FCA, came back to the room. I didn't know anything about it. And he said, hey, I went to a meeting tonight. Maybe you'd be interested in it. Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Whoa, yeah, I'll do that. I go to church. I'm a Christian guy. So the next week I went. And like tonight, it was a rainy night. I was going to a Christian meeting. I'm a rule keeper. I grew up going to church. Don't you know, I went in a coat and tie, dressed in a raincoat. Football players sitting around there in gym shorts, T-shirts, their muscles hanging out, you know. And I walked in. Somehow I got the wrong time, and I showed up 5 minutes before the group was going to end. So 5 minutes was coming down, and I walk in the room. Everybody kind of looks at me, and I just sit down. And next thing I know, the guy's wrapping up and closing in prayer. And so I got up to apologize. Went to him. I said, I got the wrong time, so I'm sorry I showed up late and so on. I said, I noticed you're studying a book. It was a paperback edition of the New Testament. Okay? I didn't even know you were allowed to publish a New Testament by itself. But there it was, good news for modern man, modern English. and I went to the guy and I said, now I noticed you're studying a book. I'd like to come to this meeting. I said, how do I get one of those books? He said, here, take this one. And I said, well, how much do I owe you? He said, don't owe me a thing. I'll give it to you. I said, I'll be glad to pay for it. He said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll give it to you if you'll read it. I said, well, I don't mind paying for it. He said, I'd rather you read it. Okay. So I took it. And I went back. I started reading. I realized this is the New Testament. And I just started from the beginning, and I started to read it. I'd never done that in my life. For all the Bible I'd had, I'd never started at the beginning and started to read it. And I just became captivated with Jesus. I just fell in love with Jesus. I read Matthew, I read Mark, I read Luke, I read John. I got into Acts. I know Jesus here. I don't like this. I went back to Matthew and started all over again. It wasn't long before the guy that was leading our group was a former Pitt football player. His name's Bob Long. He's one of the half dozen guys along the way. He's one of two that I'll tell you about. He approached the Christian faith like he would a football team. And what I mean by that, I mean, if he was a football coach, he demands that you be at practice every week. So he had three guys that he had discipled the year before. And coming into the next year, he challenged those three guys to find three guys. And then we'd have a group of 12. Now, that would be apart from the FCA big meeting. Okay? This would be a discipleship group. You had to make a commitment to be there. You had to make a commitment to do it. We had to memorize scripture again every week. We had memory verses. We had to recite them. So it was more Bible. I'm used to that stuff. And I was a quick learner, so all that went well for me. one of the guys that was in the group was another basketball player. He had scooped me up into the group. But over the course of the next 10 weeks, I realized these guys were talking about a relationship with Jesus Christ that I knew nothing about. To me, the Christian faith was you believe certain things, like the Apostles' Creed, or at least you say you believe certain things, and there are certain rules you keep, the Ten Commandments. Like the rich young ruler, I thought I'd done all those things from my youth up. Like a rich young ruler, I hadn't even begun to keep the first commandment, but I would have thought I did. But these guys were talking about Christianity in a way that I just knew nothing about. And so by the end of the first semester, I'm down on my knees before the Lord. I'm saying, I always thought I was a Christian, but I don't think I know you. I don't think I know anything about you. But I know I want to know you. And so at the end of the first semester, I'm giving my life to Jesus Christ. Like I said, that was my freshman year, sophomore year. I'd make the varsity team. I was playing there, but I'd say I was playing there. I was practicing there. I sat on the bench, except for those 4 minutes. But during that time, the Lord began to work in my life with a sense of calling to ministry. Part of why that was, as I said, the guy that led me to Christ approached the Christian faith the way he would have football. And the verse that he kept drilling into us was Matthew 16:24. Then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. It began with being a part of that group. We met Sunday nights at 9 o'clock. You had to be there, just like you had to be at practice. There were no excuses but one. The death of your mother would provide an excuse. And if you followed up and said, not my father, he'd say, I got to draw the line somewhere. That was just his way of underscoring how important it was. And so for, you know, the next years, I'd be there every Sunday night, 9 o'clock. He was pouring himself into us, challenging us to live for Christ. He had spent five of his summers working with youth on the Lower East Side of New York City. He wanted us to do, I was following him, I was doing whatever he was going to do, and so I was ready to go to New York City to work with youth on the Lower East Side, and something happened. I never knew what it was, but something bad happened to Young Life in terms of funding that year, and the whole thing fell apart about 3 weeks before we were to go. Suddenly I've got nothing to do. Well, we were taking a trip up to New England. We, there were half a dozen guys, two of us were seniors that were graduating. They were headed to Gordon Conwell Seminary. The rest of us were just taking a road trip. So we went up there, and while we're up there, the guy who was leading the project in New York City calls my mentor. He said, "Hey, those two guys that were coming to New York City," he said, "are they still available?" He said, "Oh, yeah, one of them's here." He said, "Well, we've got something new. We're going to start in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Lower East Side, inner city work, the same." He said, "Do you think that's..." "Oh, sure, they'll be there." He said, "Well, is there any way the guy you've got could be here tomorrow night?" He said, "The committee's meeting. It'd be nice to have somebody put in front of the committee that they could see what this actually looks like." "Oh, yeah, there's no problem whatsoever." We were in Boston, Massachusetts. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania is a long way from there. And he got off the phone. I said, "Bob, how am I going to get to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania?" He said, "You're going to hitchhike." This was a different world and a different day. All right. It's not recommended any of you do the thing like that. Next morning, early in the morning, he gets me up, drives me down to the head of Mass Pike, buys me a road map, and the Lord be with you. Off I started to go. And first ride that I get is the back end of an old ambulance. So these guys had bought an old ambulance. It was kind of the days of the hippies. This thing had been turned into a hippie thing. It smelled of marijuana when I got in there. They weren't smoking it at the time, but I didn't know what was ahead for me. But anyway, they asked me where I was going, what I was doing. I told them I was going to Bethlehem. The driver said, "Well, how are you going to get there?" And I said, "Well, right now I'm just going down 95. They said, "You don't want to do that." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, you got to go through Rhode Island." He said, you can't hitchhike in Rhode Island. He said, "The cops will pick you up there. Highway Patrol will pick you up." I said, "Well, what do you recommend?" I said, "Well, if I were you, I'd go all the way across Massachusetts, go down to New York Thruway." Anyway, but it worked out. I got there in time for the 13 rides, 11 hours on the road, but we got there. And that would be the place where my wife enters the picture, because I ended up working for the Young Life leader that had been her high school Young Life leader in Philadelphia. He had since moved, gone to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and that's where the second woman that shaped my life would be met, through that summer working there. That was the summer when I tell people that was when I really was a pro basketball player, because they paid me to be out on the streets to meet kids, and the way you did it was to get out on the playground, and you just play ball all day long. You pick up, and once you get to know a few people, you try to invite them to a Bible study or another activity or something like that. But that's all I did for the summer, was go out and play basketball and try to talk to people about Jesus Christ. And that's where my sense of being called into the ministry began to solidify. So by the time I was coming back to school to start my junior year, I now believe that I was being called to the ministry. I needed to prepare for seminary, and I was convinced that I had met the woman that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And since many of you know her and whatnot, it was just her heart for the Lord and her heart for the poor and the oppressed. She had grown up wanting to marry either a minister or become a nurse in Vietnam. She met the minister first, so she didn't end up in Vietnam. That's where the second woman came in to my life. After that, I would say along the way, there were several other pastors that I worked with. I've been blessed to have been incorporated into good churches under good pastors. to watch them, to learn from them, etc. I've never had to do the solo job of being alone as a pastor. I've always been in a multiple staff situation. And it was just the Lord's blessing, because I don't think I would have ever survived there. People used to say to me regularly and so on, why didn't you ever get your own church? And, you know, I worked with Glenn Connect here for 13 years. Why don't you get your own church? And I said, well, do you know what Glenn did in college? And I said, no. I said, Glenn played tennis. I said, you know what I did in college? I said, what? I said, I played basketball. I said, do you know the difference there? I said, if you're a tennis player, you've got to hit everything that comes across the net. I said, you're a basketball player, there's one ball in play, there's five people to take care of it. I said, I wouldn't have made it as a tennis player. I needed to be a team player. There was a role that I could play, but I couldn't manage the whole thing along the way. So I had the benefit of working with great pastors along the way. If there's any good that has ever come out of me as a pastor, it's due to two women, my mother and my wife, and a half dozen or so men along the way that took me under their wing, formed me, shaped me, and the Lord brought me here, and I'm just never able to find another job. I've been here now 40 years. Well, I did find one other job. I got exiled to the seminary after being in the church 20 years. Now I've been 20 years plus with the seminary. But for the young people here, lessons on this. First of all, I didn't know the Lord till I was about 18 years of age. The light had never gone on in my life. But because of how I was raised, not just in my home, but in my church, and all the Bible I learned, when the light went on, the room was not empty. My mind was full of Scripture. And when the light went on, it all came together in a wonderful package along the way. I was blessed to have a mother who prayed for me every night and was praying for me even before I was born along the way. The prayers of others are very precious to carry you along the way. somehow I made it through college in 4 years, changing majors five times. But I got out along the way. I took a year's internship, which was our first year of marriage. The plans to go off to Gordon-Conwell didn't materialize because second year of marriage, we became parents unexpectedly. And that had a tendency to root us right where we were, since I couldn't afford to move. But along the way, the hand of God's providence turned out to work together for good, even when we didn't know what we were doing. Before I came here, some of you know, I, after seminary, went to do a PhD. But to do that, we had to go year by year. We never knew whether we had enough money to take the next step in the journey. So I first went to England for 1 year. But I've got one child. I got to figure out how am I going to provide for them for the next year. We went through 5 years of the stress of never knowing what the next year was going to bring. Now, God was always faithful. I mean, we never went without food. We weren't kicked out and homeless. God was faithful, but we would have preferred to know what was ahead. We just never did. God was giving us enough light to keep going, but never the assurance of knowing what was ahead. When I finally left England, to come back, I still had not finished my PhD dissertation. I was still writing up the final copy. I did not have a job. I had two kids. We were living with my parents. They had five kids. They had a big enough house. It wasn't my wife's dream life. to be living with my parents, to have two kids, and no money. Emily was still in diapers at that time. My wife would have to ask my mother for money to buy diapers. Now, my mom and dad were committed to this project. They were happy to do it. Everything was fine, but it wasn't. So Connie just thought we had to get out on our own. You know, we ought to do that. And as soon as I'm done. So we had settled. As soon as I'm done, we're out of here. If I got to sell shoes or whatever I got to do, we're going to do it. All right, where are you going to go? They're going to move out. What are you going to do? We decided we had to build our life around a good church. Where would we go? We had two good options, we thought. Go to Philadelphia, where Connie had family, and Jim Boyce was the pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church. We would always attend there when we visited her family. So we'd go to Philadelphia, sit under Jim Boyce, try to make a go of it there. Or we could go to Washington, D.C. I had a good friend there by the name of Dave Coffin. Dave was a guy that could solve any problem. If anybody could find me a job, it was Dave Coffin. And Dave was in a good church, pastored by a man by the name of Glenn Connect, or so I thought. What I didn't know was that Glenn had left D.C. and had come to a place called Columbia, South Carolina. But we decided we needed to build our life around the church, either under Glenn Connect's ministry or under Jim Boyce's ministry. And as we got to the end of March, and I was within a month of finishing, my daily routine had been to type all day long a dissertation, print it out, go home, correct it all evening long, write something else for the next day, go to do that. That's what I'd been doing for months. And one night the phone rings. And the phone rings a few times. Somebody answers the phone. Then my wife yells up the steps, "Mark, it's for you. Glenn Connect is on the phone. He wants to talk to you about a job. Tell him you'll take it." This was so far off the map for me that I thought it was some kind of a joke. I just thought it was a joke. And I said, "Well, I'm on the other line with the President of the United States. Tell him I'll call him back when I'm done." "Mark, I'm not joking. Glenn Connect is on the phone. He wants to talk to you about a job. Tell him you'll take it." And I got on the phone. Sure enough, it was Glenn Connect. They had been trying to track down a reference on somebody else that they were about to vote on and call. There's a story on that. But I don't have time to tell it. But search committee was voted 8-1, and they were going to vote the next week, and it was going to be 9-0. But something happened in there, and that's because of that something that happened. Glenn Connect, who had been the pastor of my friend Dave Coffin, the guy that could find a job for me anywhere, something happened. They decided they needed to get another reference on the guy that they were looking at, and so the search committee chairman, Randy Folks, Steve's brother, said, "Well, Glenn, do you know anybody you could call? Can we get more information on this guy?" He said, "I think there's a guy I could call." So he calls my friend Dave Coffin. He said, "Do you know so-and-so?" He said, "No, I don't know him." he said, "But the guy you want is Mark Ross." And Glenn said, "Well, we're not looking for more names at this point in time. We're looking for more information on this one guy. We've been at this about 6 months." They said, "I don't care what you're doing. The man you want's Mark Ross." And Dave said, "Glenn, I feel so strongly about this that I'm going to put you under a vow that you will not do anything else until you have talked to Mark Ross." He said, "That's how strongly I feel about it." So when Glenn called me, Glenn said, "Look, I don't know that I have a job to talk to you about. Search committee is going to meet next Wednesday night. They've decided to pray about it one more week. We could vote 9-0. This thing's over." He said, "But somehow or other, God put us together. So let's just talk it through." And so we talked it through, and he asked me for a resume. And the next week, they decided they would wait to visit with me, and that's how I ended up here. The hand of God's providence, going back from before I was born, put me down here in the South, a Yankee come South, and somehow or other I lasted. Had a lot to learn, had a lot of rough edges to get rubbed down to be worthwhile as a pastor. You know, I nearly got ran out of town in the first 2 years here. But fortunately, I was next to Glenn, and he spared me from disasters along the way. But that was the hand of God in my life. What I was, raised in a good situation, but lost as I could be. Got to college for reasons that had nothing to do with religion or faith, and that's where the Lord had brought me by his hand. It would be the end of my basketball career. It'd be the beginning of my life as a Christian. And then by the hand of God, I end up as a pastor in this church, and now been in this city for 40 years, and the hand of God has been good. So, thank you for sharing this time with me.